From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. Vampire Weekend have made their third album. It comes out May 14th, and I think it's their best. That's not an easy thing to do for a band that's had so much seemingly instant success their first time out. They're still a New York band writing about New York things. That and their references to hip-hop and other musical styles continues on Modern Vampires of the City. What's changed since their 2008 debut and their 2010 album Contra is how this music comes together. Ezra Koenig and Rostam Batmanglij are in NPR's New York Bureau, and I'm at my end here in Washington, D.C., and for the next 40 minutes or so, we're going to talk about this new record, a more intricate record than any before. We're going to talk about how it was thought about, how the songs became songs, the influences from John Lennon to the Souls of Mischief and more. And while the band still maintains such a distinctive sound, there are darker moments on this record, maybe more thoughtful and reflective songs amongst all that pop fun. And you get that right off the bat when you look at the record cover, a black and white aerial shot of their city, New York City.
Well, Rostam found that picture, and the first time he showed it to me, I was struck by the kind of celestial nature of it. I was really struck by how you kind of see the far downtown financial district buildings popping up through the clouds, and there's something very kind of fantastic and mystical about it to me. So that was the first thing that I saw when Rostam showed it to me.
It's a black and white photograph of New York City from the sky. It's a lot of haze, a lot of smoke.
Well, it's actually smog. It's pollution.
And I lived through that. This is the 1960s. The 1960s where you would put a glass of milk down on your stoop, and a half hour later it would be coated with a little black film. It was rather disgusting in 1966, which is about the time that picture was taken, right?
Yeah.
What attracted you to use this as an image for the record? We'd start to talk about the music and so forth.
Well, I think there's something kind of unknowable about this image. In one way, it is New York, but in another way, it's a surreal version of New York. It's an unreal version of New York. And in the same way that on the last album, Contra, there's this image of this girl who's looking at you, and she doesn't reveal anything, really. Mm-hmm. There's no one emotion you can attribute to her. I think in a similar way, this album cover, I don't know, it draws you in because you want to know more about it, but it's hard to know about it in some way.
One of the great things that happens with as a listener of music is when I can interpret and it's not done for me, and I think that's sort of what you're getting at. And I'm going to play, if I can, the opening cut to Obvious Bicycle, and in some ways revealing your thoughts about this is in some way takes away from some of the magic for people, but then again, once you start listening to a record a bunch, whatever you say today, people won't remember it. And they'll have their own interpretations in their own life with this. But I'm going to play the top of Obvious Bicycle. And what I want to talk about just a little bit is are the lyrics.
Mornings come, you watch the red sunrise. The LED still flickers in your eyes. All you are to spare, face the razor. Because no one's going to spare the time for you. Gonna watch you as you go from a house you didn't build and can't control. Oh, you ought to spare your face the razor, because no one's gonna spare the time for you.
You ought to spare your face the razor, because no one's gonna spare their time for you. Not very hopeful. A little bleak, guys.
Well, it's if you don't like to shave. Okay. It's a positive message.
Having never grown a beard, I just didn't see the world that way. This record, off the bat, from the cover, the black and white cover, the smog, those opening lines, darker than ever, at least in my vision of things. Let's talk about the sort of place that got you writing about this record. Where do you even start? I don't even know who was the instigator. Was it Rostam? Was it Ezra? Where do you begin here?
Well,
deep breath.
It's difficult to answer. Whenever we finish one record, we usually have some sort of conversation about what the next one will be like, even if it's just for fun, kind of daydreaming about it. And there are some very vague ideas floating around, you know. And then, you know, we're on tour, we're busy touring behind Contra, so things are floating around, including the original instrumental that Rostam made of Avi's Bicycle. I spent a lot of time listening to it, and we actually didn't talk about it.
When did he make that?
I made it in June of 2009, before we finished Contra.
Wow.
We were in this phase in Contra where we're just finishing songs. And when I get into that phase, sometimes I want to rebel, so I start something new.
And just for people, I'm just going to throw this in the background one second. What was it? Was it the beat? And was there any piano?
This song is interesting because it evolved, but the piano chords...
You say involved? You mean evolved?
It evolved. Oh, okay. It started with a very hectic drum beat that I made, and that inspired me to play piano, and I just played these sort of simple piano chords that came very quickly. I was listening to Plastic Ono Band, the John Lennon album, a lot, and that might have had some inspiration on me.
Because he likes that, and Phil Spector likes those echoey piano things, right? I mean,
well, yeah,
the piano
it's
a slapback to it.
It's just that simple, that's just those simple chord changes.
Right. Oh, that too, yeah.
Did
you strip away all that drumming, all busy drumming then?
Well, yeah, so I sent Ezra the busy drums and the piano, and he wrote on top of that. And then from there, we kind of continued in the songwriting process, and the song was evolving, and I came up with some chords for a bridge, and Ezra came up with lyrics and a melody on there, and we just kind of kept going, and then we pulled away those hectic drums, and we actually replaced them with a sample, which is the only recording sample on the record.
Is it this? Is it...
No, it's not that.
No, it's there from the beginning. It's the drum beat.
It's the boom.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you're doing this, and when you're writing and going back and forth, different rooms, even different cities?
Sure. I mean, I probably, you know, so I had the original beat that Rostam sent. I probably listened to it 100 times, just little by little over the course of a year, a lot of times traveling on a plane somewhere, and just very slowly coming up with some lyrics. I think the Razor part was the first, but just little by little coming up with some different pieces. And then by the time we actually got together to make the first kind of demo of it, you know, actually just trying to lay down some vocals, that was already a couple years later when we were finally off the road. We were both in L.A. We got together casually just to try to work a little bit, and then that was the first time I actually put that stuff down onto the beat. And then we felt pretty confident in the song, and like Rostam said, it took a long time to finalize the arrangement, but we knew there's something special about it from the beginning.
Who is this person? What decade are they living in? Is it someone who's grown up in New York? Is it? I mean, that's sort of the feeling I started to paint. When I listened to it, I pictured somebody maybe who didn't grow up in this country that maybe was living in New York, and I don't know.
I hadn't thought about that.
Good. Well, tell me what you were thinking about.
Well, I pictured pretty much every song on the album more or less taking place in the present moment. I think there's different ways to think about the present moment. You know, there's like a more mystical way, and then there's a factual way, but I don't think of any of these songs as taking place long in the past or anything like that. This song always struck me as kind of different territory for Vampire Weekend, just because it's the voice is kind of giving advice to somebody else, maybe somebody younger, kind of has a different tone than any song we'd written before.
This is Obvious Bicycle, which has a not an obvious title to a song, because it never mentions the word obvious or bicycle, and there's nothing...
That's a product of the fact that that was what I named it on that day.
Yeah.
However many years ago it was, and I didn't expect the title to stay, but it did. It just ended up sticking.
There's something about writing music and writing words. I assume you're writing on computer, because that's what happens. You have to give it a name. You're forced. There's something says to you, now is the time you're going to name this thing, and yeah, you're right. Often they stick. So I love the title. Great title. I'm going to play another song for you. Why don't you tell me what this is about? I'm going to leave your microphones open, and so as soon as you start to, if you start wanting to say something about it, I'll just pull the music down underneath.
Modern vampires of the city, blood.
This is not you.
Blood. You could have come from Rima, or you come from jungle. Could have come from firehouse, or you come from tower hill. One blood.
Yeah, that sounds good. Junior Reed.
You could
What's your attraction to Junior Reed, and is there talk about any connection between this and your
album? Well, I mean, yeah, the obvious connection is the title of our album, Modern Vampires of the City, is the opening line of his song, One Blood.
Inspired by the opening line.
So it's an allusion to this song. Yeah, I mean, this is just like such a classic song. It's been sampled a lot. And I always like the message of this song, the kind of one blood, unity of man message. But there's always something just kind of haunting about the phrase, modern vampires of the city. And at first there was something that kind of seemed funny about calling a Vampire Weekend album Modern Vampires of the City. But then I do feel like there's some kind of deeper resonance there too.
A little more. He sounds so good. There is, on this record, a very different production, and I'm not going to stretch this too much with Junior Reed, but even Obvious Bicycle and other songs on there, there's lots of space in your music, much more space. And really, for me, the big change, what I heard, was this didn't feel like a band making music together in a studio, but it feels much more composed. But I didn't lose any of the sense of excitement and so forth that you get as a band all making music together in a studio. But I did get a sense of songs that really had a lot of thought going into them, the way they would develop. And maybe I should play a little of one of those, maybe, or you have a suggestion for one of those, and then we can just talk about how those things came to be. Or am I on the wrong track here completely?
You're definitely on the right track. And I think what you're getting at is that when we make a new album, we treat it as a recording project. And
would you say that's true of all three projects, or more so here?
It's something that's evolved. On our first record, we could play pretty much every song before we began to record it. And on the second record, about half the songs, that was the truth, we were able to arrange them as a band, and then another half kind of were more a product of the studio. On this record, we wrote songs in many different ways, and we got together and worked on them in very different ways. But the songs that we ended up pursuing and the ones that ended up on the album were a product of treating the making of the album as a recording project and putting the recording first and foremost. And the word composed is right to some extent. But I hesitate to use that word because we also were pursuing spontaneity whenever we're writing things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was written really fast. We got together and we wrote a lot. And the songs that we ended up keeping often were ones that where the initial spark happened very quickly. And a lot of the initial melodies and the chords and even the drums happened very quickly. And we were kind of flying by the seat of our pants.
So let's play a song, Hudson.
Hudson died in Hudson Bay. The water took its victim's name. Now rivers rise toward Riverside to change their names again. A stranger walked in through the door, said all apartments are pre-war. We laughed and asked him for his name. He stayed until the end.
Let's talk a little about how this song came to be. What was the first element, for example? Do you remember?
The first element were some chords that I wrote, the kind of verse chords on the piano, but I didn't really make a recording of it. And then Rustam and I went to Martha's Vineyard and with the express purpose of writing songs for the album. And
when was this?
April last year.
Okay.
And so we started trying to turn it into a real song, and you know, Rustam was writing the bass part and adding the drums using you know, different drum sounds, but you know, just working on the computer and kind of composing it that way. And then Rustam wrote this kind of second descending part. Later in the process, we brought in this chorus that had previously been from another song that CT and I had written. So, you know, we were kind of like feeling our way, finding the different pieces to make it all work. And
what sort of time frame are we talking about? Because this could be an afternoon or this could be a week. Or
well, sometimes we make it the first little recording very quickly. And that kind of gives us a sense of, if it has legs, is there a nice melody? Does it have some sort of identity in terms of production? It's always a good sign when you feel good about the song and good about the production ideas and the arrangement from the beginning.
For me, I think the test is if you become addicted to listening to it, which is a little bit shameful and embarrassing, and it's nice to be able to do it without anyone knowing that you're listening to your own music, but when you are addicted to listening to it, it's a great sign. It means it's good. You know, it's kind of how you know.
Let me play a little more of this Hudson piece.
Hudson Bay, but I was born on Sutton Place. The rising tide helped me decide to change my name again. Some intend to linger on, and some make haste from Babylon. Some will roam their ruined home, rejoicing to the end.
Over and over. Tell me about the people you work with to put this together. Who produced this record?
Well, there's two producers. One of them is myself,
yeah.
And the other is Ariel Rechscheid. And we co-produced every song on the album. And the way that we worked was Ezra and I initially went out to L.A. and we sort of brought all these recording sessions that we'd started, and we were able to open them up very easily.
These are the Martha Vineyard ones, the other places you might have worked on.
Yeah, we worked a lot in my apartment in Brooklyn, too. Mm-hmm. So we opened up the sessions, and then we sort of started to take stock of what needed to be done in order to get to a completed song, a completed recording.
And how many things did you walk in with? Did you come with 20 songs?
Well, what's interesting is we had a sense of every song that needed to be on the record, because at that point we'd spent about a year in this sort of writing, recording gestation process. So then we sort of started to take stock, and we set a goal for ourselves. Would be in August, Chris and Chris would come out and we would record the drums and the bass parts for the record. And so in order to get to that point where we were ready to do that, we sort of killed ourselves for about 2 weeks working like 12 hours a day on these songs.
So Chris and Chris really would have to play at the pace that everything was written at. They'd come in, you'd have drum parts, and he'd hear it, and you'd strip them away, and he'd play live drums to it. Is that
sound well? What we ended up doing was recording the drums and the bass to tape.
You say tape, do you mean like analog tape?
Yeah, analog tape, and that was something we hadn't done before. We would integrate those parts that we'd recorded into our session, and then, like you said, sort of build things back up again. And if some things needed to be re-recorded after that, they could be re-recorded. If they were working together, they could stay in. So, you know, on the song Don't Lie, for example, there's acoustic guitars that I recorded in Martha's Vineyard in this little cottage. And those acoustic guitars have made it to the final recording. From that very first day, from the inception, they never needed to change. In fact, they had a sort of a quality that we liked. There's other moments like that, like on the song Step. The chorus is Ezra singing into my laptop with the laptop microphone, and you can hear the trains going by my apartment. But we like the quality of that recording.
Tell me when the trains are coming, or is it later?
it's probably one of the, towards the end of the song, about 80% in, I guess. Yeah, there it is.
Okay, I'll give it a little headway here.
There it is. Can you hear that roll?
Yeah. Let's let the song play out.
I feel it in my bones. Stronger now, I'm ready for the house. Such a modest love, I can't do it alone. I can't do it alone. Every time I see you in the world, you always step to my bed.
So there are a few interesting things going. There's a lot of interesting things going on. I love that song. The song's called Step, as you mentioned. But let's talk about things that are playful with voices on this record. We just heard a few examples of that. You can sing deep. You sing deeper on this record maybe than before, but that wasn't just you singing deep.
No, I mean, even on previous records, we haven't been too shy about really messing with the vocals, but especially on this record, it just felt right on a lot of songs, and it was songs like Yahe and like that part of Step that you just heard. It kind of just fit the vibe of the song, and to us, it makes perfect sense that you would, you know, a vocal performance is very important, but also the way that the vocals sound. I mean, we've really wrestled with certain songs trying to figure out how the vocals should sound. I mean, I think you can ruin a song by having the wrong vocal sound, so, you know, it's important to have like a pretty broad palette.
You mentioned there was only a few samples on that. I assume that's a chorus sample, right? I mean, or is it a chorus synth? Or
it's an interesting collection of someone got a group of kids together.
Wait
and
a minute,
actually,
you guys, or just when you say somebody,
somebody got a group of kids together and had them sing every note in the scale that they possibly could, and then mapped it across a keyboard.
I'm going to play a song for you, and again, I'll leave mics open in this case, and then you tell us a little. Let's let it play a little, people get a sense of it. This is not you.
Yeah, this is Souls of Mischief, Step to My Girl. Yeah, so Souls of Mischief, I've always loved, kind of associate them with the first time that I started really becoming a music fan as a young teenager. And this song apparently was recorded around the time of their first album. It's called 93 Till Infinity, but it never made the record, and it kind of floated around as a bootleg for a while. And I only discovered it, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, but it always really stuck with me, and especially the chorus, which I didn't know where it came from, but they're kind of like scratching somebody saying, every time I see you in the world, you always step to my girl. And just slowly, as I listened to this song, I found myself kind of writing this alternate song kind of based on that that phrase. Uh-huh. Later, we found out that in and of itself is a sample from a rapper called YZ. We didn't know that at the time. So this was kind of the inspiration to write this other song that became Step. So White Lake and Sajay has to flip. I found mine, so find your own companionship. Every time I see you in the world, you always step to my girl. That's so white. Why is that? Brothers get jealous when I'm chilling. Yeah, that was it.
Right, and then I'm going to play just really quick. I'll find your spot. Just because people don't know these songs yet. Mine was in tune with the boombox and Walkman. I was a horrible girl that was back then. The gloves of love, the wisdom teeth, I love what you're on about.
Yeah, and you can hear the way that the vocal melody of our chorus kind of riffs on that saxophone sample that you hear in the Souls of Mischief song.
Absolutely.
And that, so, you know, we had to go clear the samples, and we had to find out where Souls of Mischief gathered all their pieces from. So, like I said, this part, every time I see in the world, you always step to my girl, comes from this rapper, YZ. But that saxophone melody was actually a cover by Grover Washington Jr. of a song by Bread called Aubrey.
Oh my gosh.
Which I'd never heard before. And so, you know, if you compare Step to Aubrey, you can see the connection. They're pretty different, but you can see how the melody kind of changed and morphed through these different versions.
That is crazy good. There's a lot of detective work. Who did most of that? Lots of people?
Well, it was easy to find out. It was easy to find out about the Bread song, just because, you know, there's so many. This is kind of a golden age for tracing hip-hop samples. You know, there's like all these websites now. So it was easy to find out about the Grover Washington cover of Aubrey and then find Aubrey. But we didn't know about the YZ sample until we contacted Souls of Mischief, because we didn't know if they had written that line or what, and never heard the YZ song before, and they pointed us to it.
There's a line in that song that just slays me. Beautiful. It says, wisdom's a gift, but you trade it for youth. Age is an honor. It's still not the truth. I just love that. I don't know where you were when you wrote that line, but good Lord. Good one.
Thanks. Yeah, I don't remember, but But they kind of seem to fit with the vibe of the song.
Yeah, I'd trade my wisdom for youth right about now. I'm going to play something. I think I've played stuff that makes it sound like this record might be a downer. And I've sort of painted this thing at the beginning with the picture and everything that this record's a downer. And there's lots of up stuff on this.
You did start talking as soon as Obvious Bicycle got uplifting.
Pop. I did.
I was like, wait, it's about to get uplifting.
Yeah. All right, well, what do you want to hear on? Unbelievers or...
Let's see, what haven't you played yet?
Something that's really upbeat that you...
We haven't played any of Dying Young yet. That's upbeat.
Okay. You toss aside like a pile of leaves. I gotta find some better weeds. 4 or 5 me to run around the bend when the government may just surround you again. If dying young won't change your mind, baby, 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 right on time. Out of control, but you're playing a role. You think you can go to the 18th hole? When you flip out the day of the championship, try to go. So good. That's so good. A lot of rockabilly feel to the vocal styles. There's a little bit of you guys know the band The Cramps, right there, that incredible guitar line that just beautiful stuff. So very different mood.
For us, we really like to stand behind every song that we put on a record, and our standards are very high. You know, we're kind of obsessed with quality control, but that also means that every song needs to have its own kind of voice and vibe. There can't really be any repetition on the record. So, you know, there are going to be mellow moments, and there have to be energetic moments, too, to kind of, like, fill out the world of the record.
I think it's one of the reasons that I said at the beginning this is one of my favorite records this year, and I think that's what, for me, makes a great record, when every single thing is distinct, but yet it all seems to hold together in a way that you may never understand why it holds together, but these songs, like, I don't know, if you think of them in any way, shape, or form as connected, whether there are characters that run through them that connect, I guess I've spent, you know, 5 listens to this record, so maybe not a fair to figure out whether that exists or not, but there are moods and so forth that seem to tie. Do you find the record cohesive, characters cohesive, or just everything distinctive, but it...
I definitely find it cohesive. I think, you know, it's the type of record, the more time you spend with it, you'll find all sorts of connections, sometimes surprising connections between different songs, whether it's a sound, a kind of musical idea that you hear in two very different songs, a lyrical idea, theme that gets repeated. I think those are the little connections that kind of make everything work, even though some of the songs are very different from one another. And that's kind of how it should be. Kind of like to think of each album as its own world or its own city, where it's a space that all these different things are happening in, and yet they kind of belong together. So there's connections all over the place.
And not only do we think of the songs within this album as connected, but we think of all of our songs and all of the 3 of albums that we've made as being sort of connected and interrelated.
Talk about that a second, because that wasn't immediate to me. Someone, I don't know if I read that you said it or heard it, which, you know, 3rd record, somebody mentioned this is sort of a part of a trilogy.
Yeah, we see it that way. Of course, when you're working on each individual record, it's something that the bigger connection sometimes you have to keep in the back of your mind, because you have to focus on just writing and recording the best songs possible. But now that all's said and done, I look back on them, I certainly see all sorts of connections, the way Rostam was saying, between each album, whether you look at them as chapters in a book or just kind of a continuation of a story. And even if you, I don't know how many people would do this, but even if you listen to them straight through, 1, 2, 3, we
That'd
like
be a
the
fun
idea.
Sunday. That'd be a fun
yeah.
Sunday.
Why not get the whole family together?
That'd be a short Sunday.
Yeah, it really wouldn't take that long. That's true.
Right.
But we love the idea that, you know, because we put a lot of thought into, you know, sequencing and things like that. That the last song on every record in some way leads into the first song on the next one, and the two records might have a ton of differences, but there is this sort of connection. So, yeah, to talk about characters can be difficult because there are no characters in the sense that, you know, you don't see Walcott on each album. This album has a song called Diane Young. Diane Young's not on every album. But if you look at them as a, you know, maybe a group of people, then I could see them kind of moving through time and space together from album to album. So definitely it feels like a trilogy now.
And you've grown up a lot from beginning a band to this point. Does a band sort of all change as you have grown up and think of the world different or think of approaches to music differently?
Well, in some ways. I mean, when I think of all three albums, if I had to like kind of boil down the making of each album to one image, at least in my memory of how I participated in the album, I always just picture sitting at Rostam's apartment, wherever that would be, you know, next to him in front of the computer. So things like that are a constant throughout. But then, of course, when you like zero in on specific musical ideas, approaches, like we were talking about before, whether the band has played the songs live before recording or whether we totally come up with it in the studio, yeah, definitely the balance has shifted over the course of three records. But in some basic sense, our approach to recording, there is something that kind of hasn't changed.
When you say the balance has shifted, how's the balance shifted? I don't understand that.
Well, like Rustin was saying before, on the first album, every song on that record we'd performed at some sort of show before we recorded it.
Gotcha.
And that doesn't mean that we didn't still spend hours and hours tweaking the recording, you know, revamping things.
Yeah, trying different sounds. That was something we did a lot on the first album. So.
Yeah, so there's still a ton of experimentation in the studio and still kind of felt like the bulk of the work happened in the studio. But on this album, there's not a single song that we played live before recording. So the elements of the process remain the same, that kind of tweaking, experimenting on the recording, that hasn't changed. But in terms of the relationship between kind of studio work, the way songs get built versus live performance, that balance has shifted. I mean, sometimes we call it, you know, pop style or hip-hop style when Rostam makes a piece of music, then I just write on top of it. And we've definitely done more songs that way. On this album, we found that was one of the most effective ways to get the ball rolling. Because sometimes we wouldn't, you know, we hadn't come up with a song we loved in a while, and then, especially when we were on Martha's Vineyard a few times, we just say, all right, I'll go take a walk, bring a pad with me, write down some lyrical ideas. You know, compose some music, start making a beat, arrange some drums and chords and stuff, come back in, listen back, and sometimes just immediately record on top of it. And so that's something that there have been elements of, especially on Contra, but on this record, that really produced some of the best songs.
I bet this makes it the inverse of playing it live. It makes it harder to do what you're doing here and bringing that to the stage, where the other stuff seems like it was on the stage and then in the studio. So
well, what's interesting is it makes the live performance in some ways more fun because we have to figure out how to pull it off.
You're and now a cover band of your own self.
Well, not exactly. And now our drummer Chris Thompson and our bass player Chris Bayo, they have these samplers integrated so they can play, you know, a drum machine if necessary, integrated with the drum kit, and Chris Bayo can trigger specific moments, just a note here or there that kind of fills things out. The saxophones he can play with his feet, basically, for Diane Young. And it makes a huge difference, and it widens our stage in a way.
That's fabulous. Well, I'm going to see you at Roseland Ballroom. I look forward to hearing the new songs live. And thank you for your time. It was fun.
Thank you, Bob.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, cheers. Ezra Koenig and Rostam Batmanglij of Vampire Weekend, the new record, Modern Vampires of the City, comes out May 14th. I'm Bob Boylan, for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.